This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Memorial Day weekend. As many of you know, last week we used a taped show because I was traveling to Texas to be in Fort Worth, Texas for bull riding and give a lecture on Western sports to Western sports athletes and particularly on brain health. A couple of things I took away from the trip is, first of all, travel. So this is, I guess, my first time flying since the pandemic has been officially declared over. But nevertheless, you know, we're still seeing about a 3% positivity rate here in Connecticut. And the number of people who have abandoned masks is striking. And I mean that not that to advocate that everybody should be wearing a mask, but wearing a mask at certain points in your travel is highly advisable if you talk to infectious disease specialists, because there are certain choke points where people are squeezed together tightly. So if you travel by air, you'll know that's when you go through the TSA checkpoint, right? A lot of people in one close area. Good time to put on a mask, not just for COVID. I mean, there's a GI flu going around, upper respiratory problems. You don't know what these other folks have. Put the mask on. Take it off if you wish when you get past. The next choke point is getting on the plane, right? Everybody's gathered around, right? Because now you're going to be put in your groups and called on with your group. Another good time to put the mask on. Also, because the filtration systems are not the same when you first get on the plane. So you can get into your seat. I personally wipe my seat down because we don't know how clean those are, especially the seat belt. And if you wish, take your mask off. I don't really mind wearing a mask except if I eat something, so it doesn't bother me. The next choke point is when you're getting off the plane. This is a big deal, right? Because everybody thinks they're getting off at the same time. Everybody gets up. And we know what has to happen is they have to switch over the power, right? So the ventilation system that's on the airplane is shut off. And then there's a lag until the airport filtration system takes over and the power takes over. So with that, that's another choke point. So I'm just advocating, and for people who are getting ready to travel by air, be mindful of these situations so that you can keep yourself healthy, especially if you're an older individual or you have other medical problems. It's always great talking to young athletes, and it's interesting for me because I was at the World Finals Sunday for professional bull riding. And then on Monday, I get to meet with a variety of Western sports athletes. Many are women, primarily ropers and the barrel racers. But what's interesting to see is how these younger people are taking a different approach to their sport. They are treating themselves like athletes in terms of better care of their bodies, better training techniques, and an interest in protecting their brain, because they realize that the fewer injuries, the more longevity they have in their sport and in life, as well as being able to earn an income. So it was great being with them, as it always is. I mentioned the positivity rate for COVID, but one of the other topics that we have been touching on here has been workplace violence. And I thank those of you who have emailed me in support of the issues surrounding the number of guns available and guns even being brought into places that we consider soft targets, churches, schools, hospitals, medical facilities. And it's been an issue because really healthcare workers comprise 73% of all workplace violence victims. That's so interesting from that standpoint. And patients are usually the ones who commit the assault, but it also can be from the patient's relatives and friends. And this is a study done in Nursing World and based on the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. So when you have a customer worker violence, it's frequently in a psychiatric setting, emergency department, some geriatric settings, and in waiting rooms. So here's my word to the wise. And that is, if you're in a waiting room, don't be always looking at the phone or the tablet or wearing headphones. Be aware of your surroundings. Probably a good idea in general. We all saw that young man who was in the seventh grade and happened to notice that the bus driver was having an episode of loss of consciousness, a health-related episode, and he was the only child without a phone, so he was more aware of what was going on. So when you're in these situations, try to be aware of what's going on and not just sit there with headphones and the telephone on your iPad and be in your own world. Observe the people around you and observe what's going on. So with that, I'm hoping we can all stay a little bit more safe. As I mentioned, a lot of Memorial Day travel out there. And interesting, because I listened to Brian Shackman this week, and he had someone on discussing, basic travel safety. And they got on the topic of seatbelts. I think we assume that everybody wears a seatbelt in Connecticut, but that's not the case. Actually, I mean, we have a high percentage of people who do it. It's 92%. But there's still 8% of people who refuse to wear a seatbelt, which, again, I find baffling because there's been so much evidence over the years that seatbelts make a difference in terms of safety for passengers in motor vehicles. It reminds me of my father's situation. In 1954, he bought a Mercury. And he did some work with a contractor for an airplane company, an aviation company. And the aviation company was kind enough to install what were airplane seatbelts in his car. So it was a lap belt, but designed for a pilot. And this person said, these things make you safer. So I grew up with seatbelts, always in the front seat. He had two there, and he had these seatbelts. And I noticed them because they were this bright green color, I guess, that they used to put in airplanes. And when he bought his next car in 1963, he just had those seatbelts moved over to the next car. What's interesting is that from the standpoint that, you know, he was an early adopter, and there are some people who just refuse to adopt or face the idea that they are safer with seatbelts. And I know a lot of folks also think, if you're in the rear seat, you don't really need a seatbelt. You do. You certainly do. And this comes up. Many of us are now using Uber or Lyft to get places. I use them to get to and from the airport. Things, you know, make sure you put that seatbelt on. I know sometimes it's a little confusing. You're trying to get your suitcase in, but don't get rolling until that seatbelt is on. And if there is one not available for any reason whatsoever, get out of the vehicle. Just get out right there. But it also brings up the subject of motorcycles and motorcycle safety. It's often interesting that we have to be more aware of motorcycles on the road. But what's interesting, when I looked at some statistics, basically, motorcycles make up only 0.6% of the vehicle miles traveled in the United States. Less than 1% of the miles traveled are on motorcycles. Yet, 18% of all occupant fatalities on the road are related to motorcycle injuries. And 4% of all occupant injuries are related to motorcycles. Now, there are 18 states in the United States that require riders to wear helmet, including New York and Massachusetts. And all the data shows us that helmets are 67% effective as compared to crashes where drivers and passengers were not wearing helmets. So there's clearly a measurable benefit to wearing a helmet if you're on a motorcycle. Now, here in Connecticut, we have a very vocal and passionate opposition to the use of wearing helmets, to say the least. And rather than forcing a debate, our lawmakers chicken out. Basically, they decide they're not going to do anything about it because they're afraid of losing some votes. But it's really, you know, people just say it's inconvenient. I'll tell you what's inconvenient. What's inconvenient is not being able to walk or talk. And we're seeing that. I've known personally two people through connections who have had fatalities on motorcycles this year already. And a lot of the argument has been that motorcyclists who don't wear helmets say they're only putting themselves at risk and should have the freedom to do that. That's not true. Because when you are injured and incapacitated, it impacts not just you, but your family, your friends, your occupation. And to be very honestly, many of the people who are injured in these accidents require very long periods of rehabilitation. In many cases, they are in a rehabilitation hospital. Their costs exceed what their insurance allows, so they go on Medicaid. So the state now has to pick that up. Who's the state? That's us, the taxpayers. So if you're going to get injured and I'm going to pay for it, I believe I should have something to say about whether or not you're practicing safety. Otherwise, don't come to me looking for the money to support that. So with that, let's hope we don't hear a lot about these accidents out on the road. Today's date, May 27th, 1755, the cornerstone of Pennsylvania Hospital was laid, and it was Benjamin Franklin's inscription was on that. That's before the Revolutionary War. So with that, a very famous hospital in Pennsylvania. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to talk a little bit about some more exciting things. We're hearing a lot about Celine Dion canceling her tour due to stiff person syndrome. And then in the second half, we're going to be with a guest. My live guest is going to be Dr. Glenn Morgan. Dr. Morgan is the chief of surgical transplantation at Hartford Hospital. This interview has been prompted by a listener who actually brought to my attention the need for liver transplantation. This particular person is in need of a liver transplant. So I started researching liver transplantation and found several interesting things about transplantation in general. And that's why we're going to have Dr. Morgan on starting at 11:30. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And I want to touch base with you, something I just read briefly. A few weeks ago, we had Dr. Setu Vora on as my guest, and he did such a great job. And he is the chief medical officer at the Mashantucket Pequot Tribe. And what's interesting, I read a piece today that Mashantucket Pequot tribal members are participating in a cancer screening effort. And basically, they're working with an outside company, a healthcare company, and what they will be doing is taking blood samples from Native Americans and members of the tribe and testing what they have and what they claim is a blood test that can test for 50 types of cancers through a routine blood draw. And this is all being funded by the Indian Health Service, but specifically, Native Americans have higher incidence of cancers, including lung, colorectal, liver, stomach, and kidney. So it reminded me of the Theranos debacle, right? We heard about that, where the young woman there said by just pricking your finger, they could test for all different types of cancer, and it was fake. The whole thing was fake, and she defrauded many investors, and as a result of that, she's going to prison. But I did reach out to Dr. Vora, who I know to be a very careful and exacting physician, and I think this is going to be something worth following. So we will follow up with him in the future regarding this cancer screening with a blood test. As many people have heard, Celine Dion, very popular singer, has canceled her world tour because she is suffering from stiff person syndrome. I know I'm dating myself when I recall that it was called stiff man syndrome. And that was kind of an oxymoron because it is found more commonly in women. But in stiff person syndrome, it's an autoimmune problem. So your body is producing antibodies that cause your muscles to become stiff and you have crippling spasms. I've had two encounters with patients that where I've recognized that they had stiff person syndrome. And it's very debilitating. It affects your ability to walk. You have severe spasms of your trunk, your back, neck. And in some cases, people fall a lot because of the spasms. They also have shortness of breath. You can imagine having spasms of your muscles around your trunk and chest. There's pain. And then there are the psychological features of anxiety and agoraphobia because you're afraid to go out because of these intense spasms. And specifically, it's an antibody your body produces against glutamic acid decarboxylase. Basically, it's an enzyme used to make glutamic acid, gamma aminobutyric acid, GABA. And GABA is what regulates excitability of nerves in the brain and spinal cord. So what happens is your nerves become so hyperexcitable that they're firing off all the time. It's really kind of a spectrum more than anything when you look at it, because you can find that people will have specific types of stiff person syndrome, where it may just affect limbs, it may just affect the legs, it can just affect the trunk. So it's really a spectrum disorder, also in terms of its severity. So where Ms. Dion may have thought this was a milder form, it in some way has progressed. We wish her well. And it's something that, although it's rare, it's something we need to be mindful of when we see patients along the way. One of the other things I did want to chat a little bit about was some of the, there was a recent article about multivitamins appear to boost brains of adults over 60. So, again, this was a very small, limited study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition stating that people who took a multivitamin had a better result in one specific area of neuropsychometric testing in terms of recalling 20 words. And the difference was so small because it was a difference of 7.1 words in those who did not take the vitamins, and it went to 7.6 words. So it was not a tremendous jump. So although this may indicate that there's something to taking multivitamins in terms of preserving memory, I don't think that it has any effect on dementia or Alzheimer's disease. Again, it's something worth watching, but I would not recommend to my patients that we all run out and start taking a multivitamin if we're not taking one now. So again, we may be hearing more about that. And I know that's a topic of big concern among listeners here. With that, we're going to take a short break before we get back to my guest. I'm going to be taking live questions through the email. If you want to email me at info@alessimd.com, I'm happy to take your questions for my guest who's coming up, Dr. Glenn Morgan. He's a medical doctor, and he's the chief of surgical transplantation at Hartford Hospital. We're going to be talking about the transplant program, a lot about what goes on nationally in terms of transplants. And then I want to drill down in specific organ transplants, specifically with liver transplantation, since we did have a listener inquire about that. And I am always mindful of what our listeners are interested in. So please don't hesitate to reach out to me at info@alessimd.com. We're going to take that break. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome my guest today, Dr. Glenn Morgan. Dr. Morgan is the chief of surgical transplantation at Hartford Hospital. And we wanted to talk about organ transplants from the standpoint of a physician who performs the transplants. Dr. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start from the beginning. How did you get into doing transplant surgery? What attracted you to this field?
Yeah, I think it's a relatively common story in medicine. It's at the time when you're training, the people whom you admire, the people who you look up to, your mentors, that often becomes the most fascinating thing. And when I was in training, the field of liver transplantation was still relatively early, and my training center, the transplants were just beginning, and so there was a lot of excitement and fascination and interest in the field of liver transplantation. So I saw all this, and I admired these surgeons who were doing this, and I went into the lab. I did 3 years of research in liver transplantation, and when I emerged from the lab, I decided that that was going to be my career trajectory. It was just very exciting. It was an opportunity to really change lives in the moment, and really one of the few areas in which you can really directly say that you've saved a life. We do this in medicine all over. We save lives, we improve lives, but I think transplantation is one where we can really, you know, snatch people from a state of dire health and give them back a quality of life that they never would have imagined for themselves.
I just find it fascinating, right from the time of the first heart transplant, how transplant surgery in general has evolved. Can you talk a little bit about that evolution?
Yeah, it's interesting, and each organ system has its own journey, you know, heart transplantation, liver transplantation, kidney transplantation. The interesting thing is the actual surgery that we do for each of these organs, and I specialize in liver transplantation and kidney transplantation, but the actual surgery that is done even today is very similar to the pioneers that developed these techniques. Thomas Starzl as the father of liver transplantation, even back as far as the late 1960s, was doing pretty much the same operation that we do today with slight modifications. And kidney transplantation, even earlier, Joe Murray in Boston, again, very similar in the surgical techniques. Obviously, there have been some modification and updates, but the areas where we've evolved is really in patient management, in the pre-transplant phase, the evaluation phase, the perioperative phase, the critical care. The medicines, certainly, that's been a huge evolution over my career and even, you know, predating my involvement in transplantation. And that's really where we've made the strides, the huge strides from patient survivals back 30, 40 years ago that were no better than 60, 70% to now routinely over 90, 95% in most fields of solid organ transplantation.
How have those drugs impacted people? I mean, there's been discussion. Someone recently wrote an editorial piece basically on, you know, using immunosuppressant drugs, kind of opening them up to other forms of disease and cancer and things such as that. Is that relatively minor or common?
You know, it really depends on how you use the drugs. I mean, this has always been the double-edged sword with immunosuppression. Sure. And I tell my patients, I said, you're going to receive medication after the transplant that it comes in two categories. The one group of medicines are going to suppress your immune system in order to, you know, control rejection of the organ. And the other group of medicines you're going to get are those that are going to control the side effects of the anti-rejection medicines sure. you're going to get. And so early on, patients may take five or six new different medicines, but then after maybe 5 or 6 months, half of those medicines will be eliminated. And so the desire is to get to the lowest possible effective dose that controls rejection and at the same time minimizes either the immediate or the long-term effects of immunosuppression. So the lower you can go to maintain a quality of life and excellent organ function, the better off the patient is going to be. And the interesting thing is not each organ is responsive in the same way. For example, heart transplantation tends to have the need for higher immunosuppressive levels for longer periods of time. Liver transplantation is on the other end of the spectrum. Liver transplants tend to need the least immunosuppression even over the longer periods of time. And so the burden of disease, you will, because of immunosuppression, does vary a little bit across organs. It also varies depending on the practice of your transplant center and your transplant team. Some programs are more innovative and forward-thinking about how to reduce or even eliminate some medicines. It's certainly not standard that you must use the same medicines across the country or even within geographic areas. And so there is a certain amount of individual variability that can impact in the long term. So right now we're still not smart enough to figure out how to avoid Mother Nature's effect with immunosuppression and rejection. That's still a goal, of course, for everyone working in the field of rejection and immunosuppressive therapy. So it is a double-edged sword. I think we're getting better as time passes, but there's still a huge need to move forward in this area so that even the side effects that exist currently can be minimized or even eliminated altogether in the future.
Can you enlighten us a little bit about the organ transplant program at Hartford Hospital? In other words, how did that develop and when did it start and really how impactful has that been at the community? For example, are the transplants only done at Hartford Hospital or are they also done at their affiliates? Or can just give us some insight into it a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, Hartford has a long and very successful tradition of organ transplantation. Organ transplants have been going on at Hartford since the 1970s. We were one of the earliest adopters in the field of organ transplantation, kidney transplantation starting first, and then liver and heart following a few years later. So, in fact, we just had last year, we had our 50th anniversary celebrated as an organ transplant center. We're a fairly decent size center. We're the third largest transplant center in New England. We do liver transplantation, kidney transplantation, pediatric kidney transplantation, and heart transplantation. And it's a very significant part of Hartford Hospital. I think we're very proud of the program. I think the system is very proud of the program. The way organ transplantation works in this country, the administration of organ transplant centers, is that the center itself needs to be located in one hospital. And so the actual surgeries are done at Hartford Hospital, and the perioperative care is all done at Hartford Hospital. But we have outreach clinics in Bridgeport, for example, where we can see both preoperative patients and postoperative patients for care before and after surgery. But as of right now, all transplant surgeries are performed at Hartford Hospital. And that's the way it is for most transplant centers, even if the health system has several hospitals or clinics across a geographic area. Generally, the surgery is done at a highly specialized quaternary center such as Hartford Hospital.
Like most programs, I'm sure it's a multidisciplinary approach to transplantation. Who are the other players on your team?
Yeah, no, it's a huge effort. And we always talk about transplantation as a team game. And it truly is a team game, probably more so than almost any other field within medicine. Surgeons are involved, and there are surgeons who subspecialize in each organ system. The thoracic organs such as heart and lung are done by cardiothoracic surgeons. Surgeons such as myself doing liver and kidney. And then, of course, we have our medical colleagues. There are hepatologists on the liver side. There are nephrologists on the kidney side. There are cardiologists on the heart side. All of these are people who not only identify patients that would benefit from transplantation, but also are extremely involved in the follow-up care. Then we have nurse coordinators who inextricably tied to the whole process from beginning through the long-term follow-up. We have dietitians on the team. We have social workers on the team. We have a psychologist. We have pharmacists. We have psychiatrists. And then all of our consultants who may or may not be involved in individual cases, such as pulmonology, cardiology, nephrology. So it's a huge team effort anytime someone enters our program. And we really, you know, like to emphasize the fact that they're adopting a family when they enter a transplant center for the first time, and they start to be taken care of under our umbrella of care. And it really does give them extra eyes and ears to listen and to care right up until the time they're transplanted, and then often for the rest of their lives.
If you're just joining us here at Healthy Rounds, we're chatting with Dr. Glenn Morgan, who is the Chief of Surgical Transplantation at Hartford Hospital. We're talking about organ transplantation. Dr. Morgan, I want to switch a little bit to the donor side. So is there, it's interesting because I once heard that donor surgery and transplant surgery is the one surgery where there's absolutely no benefit to the patient. I mean, other than the fact that they're going to go through a surgical procedure with risk. I found that interesting because I never really thought of it that way, other than the fact that they really stepped up in a big way. I guess that's true, right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, and of course, Tony, you're talking about live donation.
Yes.
Which we do a lot of. Yeah, so live donation for kidney transplantation and to a much, much lesser degree for liver transplantation is an extremely important part of what we do and offer our patients. And we, and especially in the kidney transplant field, encourage live donation above all other modalities. And you're right, other than the altruistic or the feeling of goodwill that you get from having, you know, done this selfless act and offering this gift of life, that there is only a potential downside for the donor. Yeah. Because they're undergoing an operation that they do not need. But they've come to us, they've asked us to take care of them. And when they understand the process and are willing to accept, the potential risks. And luckily, there are very few risks. It is a very, very safe operation. But any surgery is involves some risk. And so you're absolutely right. There's absolutely no physical upside to being a donor. But there is that feeling of good, the sense that you've done everything you could possibly do, and the psychological lift that one might get from that process, I think, brings these people through successfully in the vast, vast majority of cases. We luckily have a very, very good track record of results in our donors, and we continue to support this and encourage this for all of our patients for whom it's an option.
I personally have so much respect for these folks. When I see a patient who has been an organ donor, it's just tremendous. It just takes me back. But another question on the donor side, age limits. So, for example, I'm 68 years old. If I were to pass on, I'm an organ donor, would you still use my liver?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if you're in good health, age in and of itself would not be a limitation as a liver or a kidney donor. You may not find a lot of interest from the heart transplant world, but certainly in liver transplantation, that would not be a limitation, nor would it be in kidney transplantation. And even in the area with live donation for kidneys, if we have people who come forward for family members, loved ones, or even just altruistic donors who are in their late 60s or even early 70s who want to go through the process of being educated and evaluated. And if they pass with flying colors, then they will be candidates and they can undergo the surgeries. So age in and of itself alone is not usually a reason to limit the option of organ donation.
I want to zoom in a little bit on specific organs and liver transplantation, which is your specialty. So tell us a little bit about liver transplantation. And we all hear things, they just take a piece of your liver and that grows in the other person. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about live liver donors and deceased donors. Can you talk a little bit about the differences and what are the facts regarding liver donation?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the key for liver transplantation, and obviously there's two sides to the story, and the recipients, people who are in need of liver transplantation, that's really the most important part, identifying that you have a need and getting under the care of individuals who can direct you to where you need to be, because that's often the problem is just getting into the system and identifying where the need is. So if you have any chronic liver disease, whether you've known it or not, and you all of a sudden develop some symptoms such as jaundice, which is the yellowing of the skin, or ascites, which is an increase in fluid accumulation in the abdomen, or you've lost weight unexpectedly, or you've had vomiting of blood, or you've had edema in your feet. Those are some of the signs of symptoms of liver disease, for example, chronic liver disease, and they chronic liver disease can evolve into cirrhosis. And often cirrhosis is very quiescent in the sense that you may not know you have anything at all, because the liver is a very forgiving organ. It can remain in an extremely well-compensated state of function for years and never manifest outward signs. But if any of the signs develop, it's important to get yourself to care and ultimately care that can direct you towards a specialist in the care of liver patients and ultimately, if necessary, a transplant center. So that's the first big part, is just identifying who the recipients are, who's in need, and who should be evaluated. Now, you talk about the donation side. So the vast majority of liver transplants in this country are done with whole organs from deceased donors. That is over 95% of all transplants in the United States. And it continues to be the mainstay of transplantation in this country and has been for over 25 years. There's a small percentage of people who are live liver donors who can donate a portion of their liver. It's a difficult process for the donor, but there are certainly some individuals in whom that may be the best option. But as I said, it's been over 25 years, and we really haven't increased the percentage of liver transplants in this country that are done using live donors. So by and large, across the country, whole organ liver transplantation is the standard of care. And we at Hartford do that form of transplantation. And as I said, success rates now are extremely high, over 95% success with liver transplantation. Again, not without risk, but a very, very successful procedure with the right team and for the properly selected patients. And, I always say our job as the transplant team is to get it right on that day, get the operation right, do everything as best we can. But very much after that, it's a lot of the responsibility is on the patient to follow our instructions. And we're always going to be there to reel them back in if they're having problems. But if the follow-up care visits and blood tests and, medication administration is followed, they can expect a full and normal life with an excellent quality of life. There are people walking around every day that you're seeing at the mall, at the gas station, in the park, who've had transplants, and you would never know it because they're living completely normal and healthy lives. And that's what we want for all of our patients.
About how many of these do you do?
So at Hartford, we do just a little less than 200 transplants a year. Nationwide, there are about 9,000 liver transplants performed in a year. So when you consider the entire burden of liver disease, which literally, 3 to 4 million people in this country have some form of chronic liver disease, and the narrowing it down to those individuals that need an organ, it ends up being about 18 or 19,000 people currently on transplant lists. And then we do about 9,000 transplants a year. It just gives you an idea of the tiny, tiny piece of the pie that actually is involved in transplantation of the liver. And so that's why the sort of whole umbrella of care for patients with chronic liver disease is critical, because just identifying those people, and particularly those who may benefit from an evaluation and a transplant, is key to getting yourself into the system and understanding this whole network under which we all work.
That's an impressive number for Hartford Hospital, for anywhere, 200 of those. Finally, I guess, how would people reach out in terms of if they are in need of a transplant, need more information about transplants? What's the best way to reach out to the transplant program?
Sure. Well, obviously, we have a great website that people can go to and learn about. There are links on the site directly to our team. For those who think they need to be evaluated, there is a online referral form that you can fill out, and you could just go to Hartford Hospital Transplant or any Google that would search that would get you to Hartford Transplant should be able to find the Hartford Hospital Transplant Program. Or if you prefer, you can call us directly. We have a 24-hour line, 860-972-4219. And there's always somebody to take a message or to answer your call, and we'll get back to you and help you to the best of our ability.
Dr. Glenn Morgan, thank you for your time today on this holiday weekend, and thank you for everything you do for our community.
Thank you, Tony. I really appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Take care. We're going to wrap things up today. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board for us, and Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. This is Memorial Day weekend, and Monday is the day we celebrate Memorial Day. Please remember the fallen, those who have given their lives so that we can live in peace and have freedom. Next up on Healthy Rounds, next up on WTIC will be Attorney John Matulis. If you missed any part of today's show, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast and by downloading at audacy.com. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.